From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's been almost 40 years since the LDS Church lifted its priesthood ban for black people. And the scholar Darren Smith says church leaders and members figured that would be enough to change generations of racist religious ideas, like the belief that black people are cursed or unworthy. But Smith has been arguing these ideas and these patterns persist, in part because church leaders haven't come out and apologized for the church's racist past. Smith says the proof that old ideas die hard can be found in the athletic department of Brigham Young University. Smith has written a book exploring the history of the black athlete at BYU and in America at large, and he's joining us today to talk about it after the news.
Hey, Benjamin Bombard here from Radio West. All this month, we're asking a favor of you, our listeners. Tell someone, anyone, about a podcast that you think they might love. Tell your mom, tell a friend, tell your dentist, tell someone who might not even know what a podcast is. Anyway, help spread the podcast love. Easy way to do that, hit the share button on your podcast app. It usually looks like a half-finished triangle with the three dots. And use the hashtag tripod, that's try with a Y. Thanks for doing that. Thanks for listening, and here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The scholar Darren Smith says there's this impression that sports is the one place where the American ideal of equality is realized. Because it's a merit system. You're a good athlete or you're not, so you rise on your talents, nothing else. But Smith says it's not exactly true. He says there's still a power imbalance in sports. He says black bodies in professional sports, for example, they're marketed as being different, more close to nature. And those bodies exist, he says, to thrill or entertain. Smith has written a book about the experience of the black athlete in sports, but his particular focus is Mormonism, particularly the experience of black athletes at Brigham Young University. Smith used to teach at BYU. He's talked to black athletes there about their experience. The story of race and sports is complicated enough, but when you throw in the history of Mormonism and race, it's even harder to unpack. Smith's book is called When Race, Religion, and Sports Collide. He's joining us today to talk about it. He's a sociology professor at the University of Memphis, a former adjunct professor at Brigham Young University, as I mentioned. He's joining us today from the studios of NPR affiliate station WKNO in Memphis, Tennessee. And Darren Smith, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
I guess I want to begin, if we could. You're an African-American man and a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or have been anyway. What's your current relationship with Mormonism, if you don't mind saying?
I dibble and dabble in the church. These days, I don't go as often as I probably should, but I don't have any animus toward it at all, any of that thing. I think I'm moving into a different area of worship these days. I'm kind of more or less doing mindfulness these days than I am going to church.
I also want to point out, and I'm not sure what you want to say about your past history with Brigham Young University. You lost your job in, I think it was 2005. You have said it was for being critical of church doctrine, trying to get the church to apologize for its racist past, those kinds of things. Is that a fair analysis?
Yeah, certainly. I think even though the individuals who were involved in that way back when would deny that, but folks who understand Mormonism and understand how the brethren operate, recognize that, they're not terribly fond of people who are critical of the organization. And so even though I was, I never really called the organization to repentance other than, simply make an apology for past historical wrongs, which, of course, they denied. And, of course, recently they came out with that surreptitious release on around midnight, I guess it was a couple of years ago, when they came out and said that Brigham Young did it. We've been saying that for a long time, that Brigham Young did it. But to have them admit that was great, but they didn't go far enough. It didn't go truly. It didn't go far enough, and it should have accompanied an apology. And I'm still on that. Until the church does that, you know, it's not all of the stuff is empty.
I wanted to ask you about how you came to Mormonism and how, as a black man, you dealt with this conflicted history. We don't need to spend too much time with it, Darren Smith, but I wanted to get a sense of how you reconcile that in the past and how you're thinking about it now.
Well, when I was a younger man, young youth, I guess, in Nashville is where I grew up and was introduced to Mormonism. You know, the missionaries, knocked on my door and found me that way. But it was kind of an interesting situation where the guy I was working for during a Christmas, seasonal work over Christmas, was an African-American gentleman who happened to be Mormon. I thought that was really interesting, really way back when. Mm. And he is the one that sort of introduced me to the church and sort of planted the seed. And the missionaries came by, and neither one of them knew each other. The other guy didn't know this particular set of missionaries, and they didn't know him because he was in the other ward. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how I was in a spiritual crisis, if you will, when I was a 15-year-old.
Yeah.
And the church seemed to answer those questions that I was looking for.
At what point in that process of investigating the ideas of Mormonism, did you encounter the fact that until 1978, they didn't give the priesthood to black people?
It was after I was baptized.
Wow.
And I was actually out door knocking with missionaries when one of the missionaries said, "Hey, by the way, we didn't tell you this." So before I was baptized, I mean, this one particular elder was I was very close to this particular guy, but they waited until after I was baptized before they broke that particular knowledge on me. But honestly though, Doug, I probably as a young, 15-year-old, I didn't really know what that meant anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask about, this book and as you put it in the book, The Journey of It. You say it was sparked when Brandon Davies was suspended from the BYU basketball team. Now, we're going to dig into this, Darren, but give us a sense of what it was about, and explain maybe who Brandon is and his suspension from the school, how that sparked some kind of thinking on your mind. Start there, if you would.
Okay. I was one of the things that has always bothered me about BYU is how they typically parade athletes out into the public. Those that have had, issues with the law enforcement or honor code violations. So they usually will put these individuals out in the public. And whereas when white players do something or people who are members of the church engage in behavior they shouldn't, you don't see their names blasted out all over the media. You don't see that. So there's a disparity there. And I think what really sparked the interest is when Brandon Davies, being the player who played in 2011 Sweet 16, I believe, BYU decided that, once they had heard that Brandon had had a premarital sex with a young woman, I believe down at Arizona State at the time, who was a volleyball player. Come to find out, he had another relationship with another woman in Provo who actually got pregnant and gave birth to his child, which was later adopted by the woman's ward in California. So I've tried to maintain some integrity with the story along the way over the years, and I actually tried to get Brandon to actually interview him for this story, but he declined to be interviewed. I think the story, what makes Brandon's story really interesting to me, is that he's a transracial adoptee. And that's something that I look at. I study transracial adoptees and their experiences being raised around white people. So I found it very interesting that BYU would actually, I would have imagined that BYU would have not paraded Brandon around the way that it had paraded around other black non-Mormon players. But he got the same treatment, although it was a little different for him. But at the end of the day, he got the same treatment of being paraded out in the public. So when I started looking at that, Doug, I started to see disparities between black players and Polynesian players in comparison to white players who were members of the church.
I want to ask you more about that, actually, the difference as you see it between black players and Polynesian players. But hold that for a second, because I want to get a broader sense of what you're trying to accomplish with the book. You say you want to explore the fate of black athletes in this country. So that's your broader take. But you want to explore that through the filter of of the LDS Church. So you see this as a more universal story. This is not just about Mormonism. It's probably, I guess, about American society and American Christianity as well.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, the church, the LDS Church, represents one particular domain where race is enacted, where race is performed. So it could be used as a proxy for other institutions that have had histories with dealing with race, particularly African Americans. And so I thought that the church, at least this particular story, would really say a lot about sort of the experience of American racism in general and how it evolved, how it began, how it evolved, how it took on a life of its own, and how discourse, policy, and rules and norms were formed around race to give whites, or at least white members of the church, a leg up in terms of their ideological, you know, positions of themselves and their moral sense of themselves as superior. So these kinds of ideas. And so, and sport has often been a site where that's been leveled, or at least that's been sort of what the thinking has been, that sport has been a neutral playing field, which, of course, it has not been.
You say the BYU Athletic Department is a perfect setting to observe those crossroads of race and religion and sport. Why is the BYU Athletic Department ideal? It seems like it might be unique.
Well, I mean, it's both. I think it's, if it's possible to be both, I mean, it's unique and simply because I think Mormons represent a very, they have a very middle class existence, if you will, right? So Mormons in the Rocky Mountain West have a very particular sensibility, but that sensibility extends beyond the Rocky Mountain West, right? Even here in the South, where I am in Memphis, we have middle class whites who are Christian, who are largely Republican, like Mormons in Utah, who have a very, they look at the world very, very similarly, particularly as it pertains to race and sports. So African Americans have their place, and their place in society generally has been at the behest of entertaining whites, either it be in boxing or football, basketball, whatever the sport happens to be. But blacks have had a long history of entertaining whites way back in during the slavery times. So this is not just a recent phenomena. So this is something that's been going on for a very, very, very long time in this country, centuries now. So I think that with the church, you see this sort of convergence of race, where we look at the denigration of black people. You see how religion was used as an ideological discourse to sort of frame that or underscore that treatment, right? And then you have this sort of conflation of society, what's happening largely in society, which of course the church mirrors that. And the treatment of blacks amongst the members of the church in terms of how they look at it ideologically is another example of the long history of marginalization that blacks have had to endure. So sports does not, or at least in terms of how BYU sort of maps that current, it's a nice place to look at this because of all these sort of different, all the messiness that comes together as a result of it. You know, you've got, what do you do with a kid who's Mormon and black, like Brandon? Yeah. And there's been other kids like Brandon who have been LDS that have gotten into trouble, but you don't hear much from them. What about those that have converted to Mormonism? You know, you don't hear much about them either. So there's really only a special group of kids you really hear about and their experiences at BYU. So my goal is to sort of bring attention and awareness to the fact that kids who are not Mormon are being, you know, prostituted in Provo, like they are in most places and in most major leagues across the country, in terms for their solely for their athletic prowess and not much for their intellectual capacity at all. And BYU is no different, sadly. Mm.
You say that you have this, you really explore this idea of, I'm going to botch the pronunciation of this term, this detachment of emotion on the part of white people, this lack of empathy, alexithymia?
Alexithymia.
Would you lay this out for us? Because part of the book really does unpack what you call this production of white racial knowledge and how professional sports has come, as you say, to market black bodies as different, as other.
What I try to impress upon the reader in this book is that racism is not just and solely an individual, you know, sociological issue, that it has deeper ramifications for our health. And also for white Americans as well, not just African Americans and other folks who've been marginalized, but whites pay a huge price too. And one of the ways in which whites pay a price for systemic racism is empathy, their lack of empathy as a group for people of color, Right. Now, there might be outliers out there or some whites who may have empathy. But in general, whites as a group in many, many great, large, studies on white empathy across the world, looking at, you know, Europeans and their empathy for different groups. We see African-Americans and folks who are with African descent tend to be at the bottom of the scale in terms of, you know, their level of worthiness as human beings. And so when I say that racism has a devastating impact on white people, it does in the sense that whites are really not fully human. If you can't really be empathic to people who, if you can't relate to people on that human level, then, you know, I'm not sure if the experience is truly a humanistic experience. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the biggest issues. Is one of the reasons why these young people suffer so much on these campuses is because I think it's an add and stir approach, right? Mm-hmm. The athletic department historically has always been for white players, right? Then you start bringing black players in the 60s, the late 60s. Then you have this sort of add and stir approach. It's the same package, but you have different faces. So you're trying to squeeze a different cultural body, a different cultural and historical experience into one that's whitened and one that's been sanitized. Those two are not going to work out very well. And it hasn't. And I think you can see that in some of the more recent protests and some of the more recent vocal enunciations being made by athletes, professional and amateur across the country in response to mostly young black men and women being gunned down, but also other injustices that continue to occur. I mean, I guess you know Colin Kaepernick's currently in the media. And what's interesting about Kaepernick's experience, too, Doug, is he's also a transracial adoptee. Yeah. Raised in a very small town in Wisconsin, actually been up there. When Kaepernick is brought up to be, you know, quote unquote black. Now, no one's born black in the sense that you're born with a black identity. That's something that has to be mapped on your body, right? You're born black in the sense that, or at least you're socialized or taught to be black. Interestingly enough, about Colin Kaepernick, he moves to California having very little impact or connection with black people because right. He hasn't really seen many black people. Kaepernick moves to California, starts playing football, does well there, meets other black people, and starts to develop an identity. He gets drafted, goes into the NFL, and all of a sudden he loses his mind. Right? So now he's oopity duper black. He's hyper black. He's super black, right? He's discovered his identity and became black. Interesting. Brandon is still not there. What keeps Brandon in his particular place is because of his affiliation with the church. And he grew up in Utah, and he's had limited opportunities to interact with blacks. He's had more being in the NFL, being in the NBA for a very short time frame. I think he's overseas playing, so he may have some more interaction there. But generally, you know, black people can be socially white, and you do have that with some of these young men who were raised in white environments, like Kaepernick and like Brandon. But Kaepernick shows us how people evolve, how change occurs, and you can see where it's leading him. So,
Darren Smith is with us, a sociology professor at the University of Memphis, the author of the book When Race, Religion, and Sport Collide: Black Athletes at BYU and Beyond. Thursday, he's going to be in Utah. He's going to be in Utah to give a lecture at the Mormon Studies Conference. This is at Utah Valley University. The event is at 2 o'clock. You can get details about it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about race and religion and sports, particularly within the LDS Church. Former BYU professor Darren Smith has written a book where he explores the experience of black athletes at BYU. And he says the athletes expelled for violating the school's honor code are disproportionately African-American. And so he connects that to the church's complicated history with race. He's joining us to talk about what he sees as the challenges of black athletes in mostly white schools, not just in Utah, but in this country. This book is called When Race, Religion, and Sports Collide. I should also mention that he's going to be here in Utah on Thursday giving a lecture at Utah Valley University. We'll give you some more details about that a little bit later on the program. I want to go back, Darren Smith, because you write a lot about the history not just of Mormon relationship with race, but Christianity, really Judeo-Christian religions throughout the world. So give us a sense of when it is and at what point these religions started connecting black people to some kind of divine curse.
I think you see the introduction of those ideas when Christianity spreads into Europe. You begin to see some of the creation of these. Europeans had strange ideas around colors and blood, bile, and all this, all these other bodily fluids. They had these strange ideas. Blackness was one of those forbidden or taboo type notions that were ingrained in the heads of Europeans. Not having ever seen a black person from Africa, Europeans were very familiar with what black meant. So what black represented in their minds was everything that was associated with, evil, baneful, lusty, criminal, violence, et cetera. So these notions, I refer to as white racial frames, have a lot to do with how white Americans have been conditioned and socialized. I mentioned earlier before the break, how whites also suffer from racism in the sense that they have a little lack of empathy. One of the ways in which this empathy is transmitted from generations preceding generations of whites is vis-a-vis these historical constructions of black people as other, right? And we there's a ton of different ideas, and the fact that some listeners might be saying, "Well, I don't believe that. I don't do that." The question is not whether or not you do it or not. The question is whether or not you've heard it. If you've heard it, that's enough to know it exists, right? Mm-hmm. So these ideas have longevity, and they've been around for a very, very long time. And what the problem is, I think, in most parts, is that a lot of folks tend to see these issues as purely moral issues, right? Purely moral issues. If people would just change the way they believe, or people would work harder, or would do whatever they have to do, then their circumstances would improve. And I wish it was that simple, but unfortunately, it's not. Given our history as a nation, as a racialized society, I would even add too, we're a racialized society. White folks in America, as well as people, all Americans, all humans, if you will, we've all inherited a negativity bias. So it's very easy to prime that bias, right? So we do it during the political election season, right? We do it with negative political campaigns. We've done it racially by priming people's thoughts about difference, right? These things that are very, very durable, that last throughout centuries. So we have to do a better job at unrooting that, and we haven't, because our institutions continue to reinforce it, and it never really gets undermined.
So this idea, as you write about in the book, that black people were cursed, was really transported here, became very much an American Christian thing. This idea, and in many ways, and you write about this in the book, it was sort of to justify slavery in some ways, that blacks were somehow designed by God to be servants. But let's talk about the Mormon aspect of all of this, because you say in the book, Mormon founder Joseph Smith very much believed the idea that blacks were the descendants of Ham. You want to explain what that means and his ideas of where black people fit in the worldview?
You bet. So this idea of Ham, one of the major ideas that circulated around 16th century, 15th century Europe and the U.S. is this idea that black people evolved from the lineage of Ham. Ham being the son of Noah, who sees his father's nakedness, and Noah curses his son Ham, right? So people have taken that curse to mean, or that literally, right? That literally means that Ham was cursed with dark skin.
Right.
And there's no evidence to support any of it in science. There's just no evidence. But yet people hold on to biblical lore is one of the pillars of knowledge that we in this country that we use. It's a part of our legal system, elements of the Bible. So these ideas that they endure. The church's take on this, or at least in terms of Brigham Young, or at least in terms of Joseph Smith's ideas, was his ideas and his beliefs around Ham and Noah were no different than the larger American landscape. He was just simply accepting and adopting what most white Americans, and even black Americans, believe it or not, believed at that time.
But didn't Joseph Smith, he allowed some, not very many, but he allowed a few black men to be ordained with the Mormon priesthood. Now, Brigham Young came by later and cut that all off. But I guess there's some impression that Joseph Smith had a more open-minded view of black people. That doesn't seem like that's entirely true.
No, because people can hold, you know, you can hold two warring notions in your head at the same time. Hmm. I mean, LBJ was a great example of that, too, right? A stark, raving racist, and yet he completely converted himself, completely transformed. His daughter, Linda, talks a lot about her dad and his transformation from a racist to someone who was much more, who saw the world in a much more complex way. So people can change. So I think even though Joseph Smith held these traditional ideas then about black people, That didn't mean he was hostile toward black people. Mm-hmm. I mean, he still had good feelings toward black people. There's a long history of Joseph Smith's relationships with blacks in LDS history. So I don't think that the fact that he had these beliefs made him a bad person. Because I think if you look at it that way, Doug, then we're falling into the same old trap that racism is only and solely about individual acts of meanness, interpersonal racism. We're not talking about that. We're talking about something much different, much deeper, much larger, much more pervasive, and much more structural in nature.
It's a big theme in your book that it's not, racism isn't an individual trait. It's something that is systemic. It's broader than that.
Man, I try to hammer that home as often as I can because people love to say, if I'm not out there doing things that would construe me as racist, therefore I'm not racist. But that doesn't answer the question of as to why black men are disproportionately being expelled from BYU, for instance, right? Yeah. Or disproportionately being expelled from public schools, for instance, or going to the school-to-prison pipeline. Such ideas of interpersonal strife doesn't explain larger systemic issues.
We should explain, as you do in the book, that Mormons expanded on this idea of black people being cursed, that it being a curse of Ham. And I guess Joseph Smith made it a curse of Cain, the son of Adam and Eve, who was the world's first murderer. And as I understand it, this idea came from Joseph Smith's, I'm going to say, quote unquote, translation of this ancient scroll. This scroll, we should say, has been kind of debunked as being an ordinary funerary text, not in fact the writings of Abraham, but this is where Mormons got the idea that black people were cursed by the curse of Cain or whatever it is.
Well, sadly, this reveals a whole lot about the Mormon faith, and sadly, and about American culture, in the sense that we believe stupid myths and half truths and verifiable evidence based truth is no longer truth as we know it, but yet it's something else. It's alternative facts. You have to look at Joseph Smith within his proper context. Most white Americans during his time believe what they believe, but even still, it didn't curtail Joseph Smith from denying black people the priesthood. Certain men got the priesthood, and he had, unbelievably benevolent feelings toward Jane Manning James and the James family. So, I mean, he's got these moments where you see the humanity in Joseph Smith. If you have to compare him against Brigham Young, I would go with Joseph Smith all the time. But then again, you've got moments, and even in Brigham Young's history, where there were moments of great, benevolence in terms of his treatment of Elijah Abel. So, you know, it's a complicated process. But I think what the two men share in common is their belief in black inferiority.
Yeah.
That's what they share in common. But the way they chose to interact and enact those differences are very, very interesting and written in LDS history.
The other spin on the story, at least from the LDS perspective, is that Mormon leaders preached publicly that black people had been unworthy or indecisive in this pre-existent state that Mormons believe in, that they had been less valiant, is how you put it. Would you say something about that? Move beyond the mark of black skin, which early Mormon leaders believed, to this idea that black people were less valiant. And what effect has that had? And do you still see that as an idea among some generations in Mormonism today?
Yes. We have American racism is a cottage industry. You remember the Nazis borrowed heavily from our racist propaganda here. So we're no strangers to racism and the differences as we conceive of. The idea that blacks were fence sitters in the pre-existence was yet another attempt to explain the inferior status of blacks. But it was this particular idea was generated by LDS church leaders who made these ideas or these claims about black people remaining neutral in the pre-existence. So before people were born, they lived and existed in a pre-existing state or a state of a spiritual bliss where they were just, they had no bodies of flesh and bone. So they had to wait their turn to come to earth. So a whole group of people that we know as in this country as African-Americans decided to, or people of African descent, let's just put the whole bunch in the whole category, the whole bunch, had to wait in abeyance until white people decided that they were ready to come down and get the Mormon priesthood. The time was right and they were worthy. That this is sort of the nuts and bolts of this idea that Joseph Fielding Smith put forward, that blacks were fence sitters. Again, it's simply BS. It's just not true. You know, and it's not true. It's racist. It's, you know, it's another way for whites to try to, prop themselves up as being the gatekeepers of knowledge. And while at the same time denigrating and destroying black people. So I don't buy it.
You mentioned Joseph Fielding Smith. And for those who don't know, that was a Mormon church general authority, became president of the LDS Church for a short time. I have to say that there are a few quotes in your book which reveal some fairly distasteful ideas espoused by Mormon leaders. I want to read one. Mark E. Peterson was in the church hierarchy, the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. He wrote this: "The Negro seeks absorption with the white race. He will not be satisfied until he achieves it by intermarriage. We must not feel so sorry for the Negroes that we will open our arms and embrace them with everything we have." Now, that was in the 50s. So that's a pretty distasteful thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's sort of, these are people who, you know, Mormons look to. They venerate these individuals, these folks who espouse these terrible ideas about difference. But, you know, but these are the kinds of ideas that sort of fueled and gave, you know, that proliferated the ideas and then cemented, in, if you will, into the practices of LDS, the LDS church, these ideas around blackness. So even though the church did lift its ban, eventually lift the ban on black men from holding the priesthood, the Mormon priesthood, and black women from being able to go into the temples, the temple ceremony with their husbands, the ideas around why blacks shouldn't have held the priesthood to begin with, black males shouldn't hold the priesthood, was always operating beneath, you know, backstage. And it still is.
Yeah. I want to get to the sports aspect of this here, but let's, before we head into a break, I do want you to respond to recent efforts by the LDS Church to and maybe not to your satisfaction, but to deal with this question. As you know, the church published an essay a few years ago talking about the church's racist past. And as it says, for much of its history, the church did not ordain men of black African descent. And it says, today the church disavows the theories advanced in the past that black skin is a sign of divine disfavor or a curse, or that it reflects unrighteous actions in a premortal life. It also disavows the theories of mixed race marriages being sins, or that blacks or people of any other race are inferior in any way to anyone else. Church leaders today unequivocally condemn all racism, past and present, in any form. Now, why isn't that enough, Darren Smith?
It's rhetoric. I mean, you have to show forth, right? You have to do some things in order for that to be, in order for those words to mean something.
But they put this online. They published these essays. That's not enough.
No, I don't think so. I think that there's been a lot of damage and harm done to blacks and whites because they've been sold these nefarious ideas about race. The church needs to go one step further and apologize for this. They always knew it was wrong, but yet they chose not to say anything about it until forced to say something about it. And so I think that if they want to complete the circle of healing, then they need to issue an apology, a public apology, to all those who were harmed by their decisions their racist decisions and actions to deny black men and black women full acceptance and full peoplehood in the church. Until that happens, it still rings hollow. It's not enough. Sorry, not enough.
Darren Smith is with us, sociology professor at the University of Memphis. His book is When Race, Religion, and Sport Collide, Black Athletes at BYU and Beyond. Thursday, he's going to be in the state. He's going to be giving a lecture at the Mormon Studies Conference. That's at Utah Valley University. You can get details about it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the scholar Darren Smith. We're talking about his book that explores the collision of race, religion, and sport. In particular, he focuses on black athletes at Brigham Young University. Let's pivot to sports, Darren Smith. It took the LDS Church well after the signing of the Civil Rights Act in 1964 to remove the priesthood ban for black men. This was in 1978 when they finally lifted it. What was going on in the meantime? On the campus, for example, at Brigham Young University, you mentioned some of the protests that were going on from other schools. What's happening at the school during this time?
In the late 60s, you've got a lot of activity going on. You have a lot of media attention surrounding integration. You have a lot of media attention surrounding, sports. And during this time, a lot of athletes are protesting and asserting themselves for the first time. I mentioned in the book, they're asserting their Afro haircuts. They're asserting their right to have the similar housing facilities as their white teammates. They're doing a lot of things to assert themselves and their full peoplehood. So in the church down in Provo, these discussions are also occurring. They're having similar discussions. And you have disagreements, and you have folks who are in agreement with the way the government and the way that the society is moving in terms of its willingness or lack of willingness to give African Americans their civil rights. So you've got this going on, but at the same time, the undercurrents beneath that is this slow but exponentially fast integration of college athletics during the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, particularly with the SEC. Right. I think the SEC really opens up Pandora's box, if you will, with the potential of black players that they could have on winning. So you've got the left coast and you've got the right coast slowly bringing in black players. You've got Jim Brown up in Syracuse. You've got other players on the West Coast. But the real turning point for college athletics, and this includes BYU. This includes BYU, comes when Bear Bryant is confronted with the Trojans. In USC, when he plays USC in Alabama, and Bear Bryant has never seen anything like he saw with the day he got his butt beat by the USC players. He couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Couldn't believe how good those black players were. So he immediately began to recruit black players. And, of course, the SEC opened up the door for black players to come in, and BYU was among that group of institutions now that are looking at black players as possible revenue and as possible ways of helping them to win games. The first black player at BYU was a guy named
Benny Smith.
Transfer from
Western Arizona Junior College.
And in fact, Doug, I don't know if you've heard much about Benny Smith's story, but Benny Smith's story is incredible, what happened to him. Just a long story short, Benny goes to BYU. He's very critical of BYU. He's talking to the newspaper there about BYU being there. He feels isolated. He feels alone. He feels like everyone's looking at him. It's not long after that that he converts to Mormonism. He graduates from BYU. He becomes a contractor working at Hill Air Force Base, doing federal contracting bids for million-dollar jobs. So he starts getting these contracts, right? So then he opens up his own company. He meets Mitt Romney for the Olympics. There's scandal around the African delegation, something about gifts being given. Then Benny Smith drops out off the face of the earth, leaves his kids, leaves his wife, disavows his citizenship, leaves the church, moves over to somewhere in the Middle East, where he becomes he's with a black Jewish sect.
Wow.
His kids have been looking for him for years now. Adam Smith, in particular, one of his sons, wants to find his father. His father's been gone now for 15 years. And so it's a really sad story how that all went down. But anyway, his story is really interesting in how he becomes the first athlete at BYU, first black athlete at BYU, then several more follow after that.
You write about how before the ban is lifted, the priesthood ban is lifted. This was interesting. You mentioned how BYU only began to admit its first few African-Americans in the early 1970s. You mentioned, of course, we just talked about Benny Smith. But there were these student protests, these black student athletes protesting. These athletes from UTEP organized this boycott. You tell the story of these Wyoming football players who were kicked off the team for organizing a protest.
Yes.
They wanted to protest Brigham Young University.
BYU was a great target for institutions or for groups that wanted to make a political statement because of its outward ban on black folks. So they were a great target, I think. And Wyoming became the sort of focal point of that with the Black 14. You've got black 14 black players who merely went to Coach Lloyd Eaton and said, "Coach, is it okay if we just wear an armband?" Right. And the armband is in similitude of our protest against Brigham Young University and the Mormon Church's position on blacks. We just want to wear it.
Yep.
And Coach Eaton lost his cookies and those players were kicked off the team.
Yep.
And then now we have we have history. By the way, CBS just did a documentary on this very thing. It's called The Black 14. It came out in February of this year.
It was Stanford which first severed its athletic relationship with Brigham Young University. Is that when the domino started to fall?
Yes, yes. And because, as you know, money talks, bull crap walks, as they say. So you're talking Stanford, a major player in the Pacific conferences, and they decide to end their playing relationship with BYU. That's huge. So that major blow, coupled with the growing crescendos of cries from individuals who belong to the WAC, and they were watching the WAC deteriorate amongst all of this uproar about BYU, tried to pressure BYU into either leaving the WAC or having the Mormon Church make a statement about its position on blacks, to no avail, right? Because religious convictions weigh out over political ones. BYU is protected because it's a religious institution. So whether or not we like it or not, they can have a belief and believe that blacks were less than or inferior. There's no penalty for that. I mean, they never did discriminate against blacks actually attending BYU. There was never a formal written policy in place. There was a letter that was sent out to all potential black applicants that wanted to go to BYU that basically said, listen, if you come to BYU, recognize there's no black people in Provo. So you're not going to have many people from your kind here. Mm-hmm. You may have to go to Salt Lake or Vegas, but those are the only two options you have. We don't allow our women and this and that and the other to do this. The letter was very explicit, but it was sent out with a very specific purpose, right? We don't want you. We're not going to say you can't come here, but it'd be better if you didn't come here.
Harold B. Lee, who became president of the church, you quote him as warning Ernest Wilkinson, who was president of BYU at this particular time. Here's the quote: "If a granddaughter of mine should ever go to BYU and become engaged to a colored boy there, I will hold you responsible."
Oh, yeah. So therein lies the key to the whole debacle over why African-American athletes are disproportionately expelled from BYU. You just found the answer right there. That's it. So one of those major issues that has vexed Mormonism forever and a day is interracial marriage, right? And you would think that in 2010 or whatever, 15 or whatever, that would be something, a thing of the past. No. We said this before, attitudes die hard, right? So when you get right down to it, right, a lot of the expulsions revolve around sex, right? Sex, and a lot of the young women who are, just mystified by these black players, they go out with these black players, they fall in love with these black players, and the rest is history. But the parents are like, we ain't having that. And a lot of these young women end up going to the honor code office and confessing their sins to whomever. And then the players, these players, are swooped down upon by the honor code office, and the next thing you know, they're dismissed.
Darren Smith, I want to ask you. So you've gone back and sort of made an accounting. I'm not sure if it's scientific or what, but you found that of 70 cases of expulsions within the athletic department, 54 were people of color. These were mostly black. 77% of them were black. Only 16 were white. Now, why is it that that has to be racism? Couldn't it be that whites have just been socialized to these honor code values? I mean, you yourself have suggested that, that they're more used to it. Some of them, you know, they grow up in places where these honor code rules are pretty clear. Why is that racism?
Well, I mean, I racist in the sense that it's institutionalized practices. Whenever a group of people are denied the same access to or the same opportunities as another group, okay, you have to call it something. Hmm. You know, you got to, particularly if you're targeting people who don't look like you, and the numbers tend to be skewed toward that particular group, you have to call it something. And we know the history of this country. White players have problems too at BYU. It's not just African American players and Polynesian players. White players too have issues, but they have more areas to redress those issues for them than for African Americans and even for Polynesians who happen to be LDS. Even though at times the church has dropped a heavy hand, or BYU has dropped a heavy hand on Polynesian players who happen to be LDS. So it seems to me that that there seems this disproportionality of Polynesians and blacks being disciplined seems to have more to do with racial politics than it does to do with honor code, specifications or policies.
You've written about different football coaches. Gary Croton was said to be too slack with his honor code enforcement. He recruited the largest class of non-LDS recruits in the school's history, a lot of them black athletes. But the school apparently wasn't happy with the way he was enforcing this. At least this is your contention of the honor code. He is removed. Bronco Mendenhall comes in to replace him, and he's quite strict with the honor code.
Yes. Partly what the honor code office is looking for in a coach is someone who obviously can win, but someone who can be a pillar of a priesthood holder and a pillar of a role model to the players. And one of the ways they do that is by making sure that the players stay in line with the honor code office and also with the tenets and teachings of the church, essentially. So therein lies another problem. You're bringing players in from the inner city communities in Texas and California largely, who have no association with Mormonism, who have known nothing about Mormonism, who've probably lived in cultural settings that are nothing like Mormonism, right? And you expect them to suddenly, refrain from doing all the things that they did prior to coming to BYU. That's just not possible to do. It's just impossible. Then you bring them to the campus that's already isolated, right, and you give them little support. And the support that you have on campus is already there for primarily white players who happen to be LDS, right? So you've got this, again, systems in place that don't speak to the successes of these players, not recognizing who they are, where they come from, right, and what additional resources they may need when they get there. There's no accountability for any of that at BYU. And to be fair, not just at BYU, but at other institutions too, at other large Division I institutions where they do the same thing, because it's not about them graduating, Doug. It's not about these kids finishing and getting a degree. It's about a labor force. It's about winning. It's about trying to find a comparable crew of young people in the primarily the big revenue sports of college men's football and men's basketball, where all the money is made in most of these institutions. It's about finding and maximizing that. I don't know if you heard about the new study that just came out recently, just today, in fact, about the controversy over pay for play, yeah. Right? College athletes getting paid. Well, the study was done by a gentleman at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. His contention is that there is a huge bias for pay for play. People are not likely to support pay for play if it's associated with black people, right? Because it tends to engage or activate the welfare, this welfare idea that most whites have been conditioned to believe about blacks as being less deserving or undeserving of these things that they should be deserving of. So you've got racial bias that largely underscores why there's such a outrage over pay for play. Why should you pay these young men money? You know, they should do it for school, to graduate. Well, most of these kids don't graduate from college. They don't even finish.
Darren, we're running out of time, and I want to get to two more quick points.
Okay.
The Kalani Sitake, who's now the coach of the BYU football team, Polynesian American, not black, not white though. Are you having a sense of what kind of position he may be taking on all of this?
You know what? I'm encouraged by him, and I think that the fact that they hired him says a lot. I mean, I wish they would have hired. I forgot the guy's name. They got a coach for USC back in the day. But that's a good start. Having him there is a good start. I think they're trying to do some things differently. I hope they are. But we'll have to see. Now, I know a gentleman at the University of Utah right now who's doing a dissertation on Polynesian football players in the church and their experiences with this whole thing. So he might be someone that could really, talk about, that side of it even more. But having him there is a good thing. That's a positive thing, in my opinion.
Final thought. You say the LDS Church needs to take this opportunity to transform the fate of black men and women. Give me a sense of what you mean. I guess what you're saying is in some ways they could start with an apology.
Well, that's always a good place to start, is with an apology. But also I think in addition to that, recognizing where these young men come from. They're coming from circumstances where many of them have not had what many of the members of the church take for granted. They hadn't had great schools. They hadn't gone to, they don't have a lot of parent support or resources to do the things that we all get to do. So these young men have a lot more at stake. And you would think, given the mission of BYU, right, its religious mission, right, that they would take that into account when they're trying to, work with these young men. And sometimes they do, but largely they don't. The numbers just don't support that they don't. And so what they've done is they've just not recruited as many black players, at least with Bronco Mendenhall. Now with the new coach, maybe that'll be different. I think he's starting to recruit more black players. So that's a good thing. These are all good things. And so I want to see, what happens in the next 10 years. But I still don't think BYU has enough in place to make this thing go well. It might go well for Polynesian players, but for African-American players who are non-Mormon, there's still a challenge there.
It's Darren Smith. His book is When Race, Religion, and Sport Collide, Black Athletes at BYU and Beyond. He's giving a lecture about black athletes in the fight for civil rights at Utah Valley University on Thursday. It's part of the school's Mormon Studies Conference. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. Darren Smith joined us today from the studios of WKNO in Memphis, Tennessee. Professor, thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction today from Adrian Moranville. The program was produced today by David Boyle. Radio West is also produced, of course, by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.